news that have such a way to...
It's a it's a complete contradiction to what the mainstream is usually propagating.
Hmm.
Ali, what's your take?
I think it's amazing that the supreme leader of Iran has issued this letter to the youth. But there's one question. Many people were calling me all night to ask his question. The question was that, like, which kind of youth is he referring to? Is it only in the religion of Islam, or is it other religion beliefs? Uh-huh. Or which kind of youth? Which age group, which youth? Like, exactly what is he pointing out? Because in the letter, he's not pointing out a specific group. So if you can explain to the viewers which group is he referring to?
Well, to be honest...
He's referring to all the youth.
All the youth.
I would guess he's referring to all the youth, like, for instance.
Yeah.
I don't think he's referring to a specific type of youth. I mean, if I was to put a specific type of youth onto it, that would actually read this and, I don't know,
he's saying the youth. I mean, if you look at the words of the letter, he says, "I don't address your politicians and statesmen either in this writing, because I believe that they have consciously separated the route of politics and the path of righteousness and truth." I mean, he's completely disregarding all the people.
Hierarchy.
Yeah, the hierarchy. He's disregarding everybody on the top, everybody who is in the older generation. And he's saying, I'm talking to you, the youth. It's just the youth of the West. And I think youth would be anybody under the age of 23, 24, 25, maybe.
Being a youth myself, as you guys nicely stated in the beginning, my age or what, so on and so forth, from London.
That's right. We do have in the studio today, dear listeners, a real-life youth.
Specifically
right
from South London.
Teenager.
From South London.
Anybody
as well
listening, then big up to all you. And anyway, basically, back to the point. Everybody back there, not everybody, that's a generalisation, but what I would say, a lot of youth, they know that, okay, the system has good stuff. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to say anything bad about the system. The system has good stuff.
Wait, which system are you referring to?
Look, like, the English system, I mean, they have nice NHS, they have good, like, for instance, clean roads, whatever, recycling. They have good system, they have good stuff. However, some part of the system is a bit annoying, and a lot of people in the youth, like, they get agitated by that.
There's a lot of, like
for instance, I would, for example, I think it was a couple of years ago when the London riots happened.
Uh-huh.
Like, a lot of my friends who are, like, who are ethnically black or African, they're not really African, but they're black, they're born up in London like me. Mm-hmm. They felt it more as an attack on themselves than anything else. So they kind of know that their system is good, but it has deficiencies within it.
Perhaps Ayatollah Khamenei is addressing the youth because he needs to address the people who are most rebellious. The youth are the ones who are the most rebellious against
free,
that system.
Or free.
Or free
is a nicer word. I
kind of like the word rebellious.
I prefer the word free. Freedom, man. Freedom. Have you seen Braveheart?
Brother,
freedom. It's all about freedom.
One other question.
Yes,
why is it only the youth in the West? Like, the youth everywhere, all around the world, and they have the same purpose and the same mission. Everywhere. It doesn't mean...
That's
you can be anywhere in the world.
I've actually got a newspaper up here.
Yes.
It's called The Hindu Daily.
So why is it only in the youth?
Published in India.
Yeah, okay. In the West.
And they've got a headline saying, Khamenei urges Western youth to re-examine Islam. I mean, I'm pretty sure the youth of the East are feeling a little bit left out here.
Well, to be honest, the youth of the East, I'm sure he's addressed many a time. Like, he's from the East, bro.
Uh-huh.
Like, he's from the East, the Middle East. Iran is in the Middle East. So the whole people around.
Whoa.
So I guess that
that's
kind
so
of
true.
So I guess that, like,
but what about the Japanese?
Brother Muzaffar, there's a youth in the north, the west, everywhere.
Yeah, but the thing, like I stated, Ali,
why is your reason why is it only referring to the youth in the west?
Well, maybe we have the answer here. I mean, just try to think about your friends, Ali Shah. I'll ask you your friends back in Scotland.
Okay.
Cool.
Scotland,
now, your friends back in Scotland, how do you think that they would react to the letter? And be completely honest.
How they would react to the letter?
Mm.
I think they would just look at the Supreme Leader like a religious leader. Yeah. They would look at his letter and they would just go on.
The youth back in London?
I don't think so. Because London, man, it's like a hub. Like, you have everybody who's anybody there.
Uh-huh.
Like I stated before, everybody who's anybody is there. Like, every single country in the world, you think of it, somebody from there is there, either studying in a uni, whatever. Like, the commuter life, the fast pace of life, like, everybody's there, to be honest. And I personally think they would really adhere and think. I remember one day I was on the train and I saw a tabloid. It said something about the Dalai Lama. I don't exactly remember what it was, but it caught my eye, and I recognized this guy is a figure. He's a figure in the East. He, like, of, I think he's Buddhist. Uh-huh. And I thought, you know what? Let's see what he's saying.
Yes, it is. I think Buddhist.
Brother Muzaffar.
I pity your young mind sometimes.
Many people.
He is Buddhist.
Yeah,
he is.
Or maybe it really is as simple as the letter says. Maybe it's as simple and easy as the letter says. Uh-huh. I mean, the letter's pretty self-explanatory. Uh-huh. I don't have one in front of me right now, the copy of the letter, so I'll paraphrase it, where he says that I'm not addressing the politicians or the statesmen because the Supreme Leader believes that they have intentionally mixed up politics and, like, made it look all wavy. But he knows that the youth...
That's what I'm getting stuck at.
Because the youth themselves, funnily enough, like, in the West, I mean, there's so many shows where they laugh at the news, like the good news. Like,
that's
news,
true. But maybe
people in the West will think he's making a political move.
Definitely. I've heard
political move. Like, I've, he's not people, genuine. He's probably making a political move.
No. Definitely, some people on the internet have been passing around comments like, "Oh, he's just drawing people towards Islam. He's just doing tabligh.
He's going towards the youth because they're searching, they're free, and this and that, and so on and so forth."
Coming back to your point about people being affected by it, I do find myself having a little blockage in my mind. I mean, I'm trying to think of my friends back in England.
Are you from Kent?
Yes, I'm from Kent.
Where's Kent, bro?
Kent is the garden of England. It's a beautiful place in the south of England.
Okay.
I think people in the West would more or less have the attitude that as long as it doesn't affect my my Friday night, it's okay. I'm fine with it.
What I was saying was, you actually took me off my stride, which was...
Do you disagree? Do you think that people... I'm struggling to try to think which kind of youths back in England or in the West would be affected by this letter.
That's what I wanted to answer. That basically, these youths, you can't really specifically pinpoint them. Like, there's people, football interests them, and it doesn't. You can't say all youths are interested in football. You can't say all youths are interested in clubbing.
Is it the uni students? Is it the educated kids? Is it the kids who I don't know.
I think it's anybody kind of who's searching. Who's searching and is basically interested in what is going on around him. Uh-huh. And to be honest, I think that net of people, that medium of people it goes beyond the youth.
I think one.
It goes beyond the youth.
Point,
it goes to anybody who's
searching. Can I make one point?
Yeah, please.
I think it's for every youth, everyone, but it's mainly for the people who can make a change.
Mm-hmm.
Like, see, there's a youth out in the West that can make a change. They've got qualities. They have ambitions, but mainly for the people who can make a change. So in the future, they can rise.
So who can make a change?
Bro, everyone has qualities. You know, like, there's youth in the West that have many qualities. They have many ambitions. Many, they're educated.
I mean, they have misinterpretation of the religion. You can argue and this and that.
Yeah.
Why specifically now?
Well,
do you think it's got anything to do with what's happening in the Levant, in the Islamic State in Levant? Well, I don't know. I'm just throwing it out there.
Definitely, everything is connected. One news agency said the timing of the letter appears to have been an important factor in issuing the letter just 2 weeks after the January 7th attack by an Islamic extremist on the Paris offices of the satirical newspaper Charlie Hebdo that set off a new wave of Islamophobia in the West. With anti-Islamization movements already gaining momentum, particularly in Germany and France.
Yep.
Stepping back to before the letter, what is the youth's impression of Islam when it comes to these kind of drawings and masses of Muslims going into the streets?
Intolerance, basically.
So,
because the minority always speak louder, like, wherever you are. Like, come on, man, Wall Street. We can forget about religion completely. Wall Street. The 1% and the 99%.
Uh-huh.
1% live like kings, 99% live like, you know what.
Wait, so you're saying the majority speak louder? Yeah.
You know, that's what I'm saying, that because of the minority within the religion of Islam that do these atrocities, like, for example, what's happening in Iraq, these beheadings and all these disgusting, like, crazy, inhumane stuff, that is always shown because it's I mean, like, if you shout and if you shout and I clap, if you shout and I clap, what's going to be louder?
So are we on agreement? Are we on an agreement here that the people who Ayatollah Khamenei is addressing is the youth in general, because number one, they have a rebellious attitude, or as Irtaza puts it, they have freedom, freedom of thinking, and secondly, because they have the loudest voice.
I would say best platform, best platform. To be honest with you, that's going to need a lot of time.
What I can say is that Ayatollah Khamenei is a genius.
He's a genius,
an absolute.
But
genius.
Do you think he came up with the idea himself, or was it like a
I'm guessing.
You know what? To be honest, I wish we had more time.
Thank you very much for your contribution, though, Irtaza.
Thank
do appreciate it.
Thank you for cutting me in once again,
dear listeners. We hope you have enjoyed listening to the show today.
Letter for you.
This has been a letter for you, and we hope
from the supreme leader of Iran. May God bless him and give him a
thank
long
you,
life.
Thank you, Ali. Yes.
And may he give many more letters in the future.
Yep. All right. Thank you very much, Ali. Dear listeners, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam.
Ciao.
A letter for you.
And this is a letter written by the leader of the Muslim Ummah.
Special program on the message of Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei to the youth in Europe and North America.
In the limelight. Joe Biden has marked the start of his presidency by signing a flurry of executive orders on a suite of issues, including COVID-19, the environment, immigration, and ethics. Some of the executive actions undo significant actions from Donald Trump's administration, including halting the travel ban from Muslim-majority countries and ending the declaration of a national emergency used to justify funding of construction of a wall on the U.S.-Mexico border. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Sam Levine. The piece is titled Joe Biden Marks Start of the Presidency with Flurry of Executive Orders. Stay with us for more of Sam Levine's article. President Joe Biden has marked the start of his presidency by signing a flurry of executive orders on a suite of issues including COVID-19, the environment, immigration and ethics. Some of the executive actions undo significant actions from Donald Trump's administration, including halting the travel ban from Muslim-majority countries and ending the declaration of a national emergency used to justify funding construction of a wall on the U.S.-Mexico border. Joe Biden also signed an order allowing the United States to rejoin the Paris Climate Agreement and end the Trump administration's efforts to exclude undocumented immigrants from the census data used to determine how many seats in Congress each state gets. The president also moved quickly to address COVID-19, signing orders to mandate wearing of face masks and social distancing in all federal buildings and lands, and to create a position of a COVID-19 response coordinator. In other moves, Joe Biden also revoked the permit granted for the controversial Keystone XL pipeline and instructed all executive agencies to review executive actions that were damaging to the environment or unsupported by the best available science. Biden also ordered all executive branch employees to sign an ethics pledge and place limits on their ability to lobby the government whilst he is in office. The new president also ordered federal agencies to review equity in their existing policies and come up with a plan in 200 days to address inequality in them. On his first day in office, President Biden signed 17 executive actions, 15 will be executive orders. As he began signing the orders, Biden, wearing a face mask and seated behind the Resolute desk, said, "I think some of the things we're going to be doing are bold and vital, and there's no time to start like today." It's not unusual for an incoming president to take executive action immediately after being sworn into office, a movement to show the nation that the newly inaugurated president is getting to work. But the breadth and volume of Joe Biden's immediate executive orders underscores how quickly the new president intends to move in addressing the COVID-19 pandemic and turning the page from the Trump administration. These executive actions will make an immediate impact in the lives of so many people in desperate need of help. Wade Henderson, the interim president and chief executive officer of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, said in a statement. Wade Henderson added, "Reversing Donald Trump's deeply discriminatory Muslim ban, addressing the COVID-19 crisis, preventing evictions and foreclosures, and advancing equity and support for communities of color and other underserved communities are significant early actions that represent an important first step in charting a new direction for our country." A flurry of activity from Joe Biden came on the same day that Democrats formally took control of the U.S. Senate, as Reverend Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff were formally sworn in as the two senators from Georgia. Chuck Schumer, the Democratic senator from New York, is now the Senate Majority Leader, whilst Mitch McConnell, the Kentucky Republican, is now the Minority Leader in the Senate. Speaking from the Senate floor, Chuck Schumer was momentarily breathless, saying, "We have turned the page to a new chapter in the history of our democracy, and I'm full of hope." Mitch McConnell, in his first remarks as the minority leader, also focused on a message of unity. McConnell said, "Our country deserves for both sides, both parties, to find common ground for the common good everywhere we can, and disagree respectfully where we must." The people intentionally trusted both political parties with significant power to shape our nation's direction. He also praised Kamala Harris's historic achievement after she was sworn in as America's first female vice president. "All citizens can applaud the fact that this new three-word phrase, Madam Vice President, is now a part of our American lexicon," Mitch McConnell said. Looming on the horizon is a second impeachment trial for Donald Trump, who the House of Representatives voted to impeach earlier this month. In addition to the COVID-19 relief, Democrats are also expected to push legislation dealing with immigration reform and also voting rights. Even though Democrats have a majority of votes in the Senate, they still face significant obstacles to get them through. That's because Senate rules require 60 votes to overcome a filibuster. A filibuster is a procedural move that can be used to halt legislation. Some progressives have called for ending the practice, which would allow Democrats to pursue sweeping legislation without Republican support, but it is unclear if the party will do that.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kHz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kHz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kHz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
A visit to Iran yields a stunning variety of culinary delights. There is a vast spectrum of foods flourishing for centuries and evolving since Achaemenid times. Persian cooking incorporates many flavors into its uniquely delicious food traditions. A taste of Persia's food can be identified by its sumptuous rice dishes, its intriguing and delicate flavors, and its combination of herbs, spice, fruit, and nuts. And one integral component to Persian cuisine is the use of saffron, the world's most expensive spice, which gives Iranian food its distinct flavor and aroma and golden hue. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. Many coveted ingredients are native to Iran, including pistachios, almonds, walnuts, pomegranates, grapes, and perhaps most notably, saffron. Iran has a variable climate with four distinct seasons. The ancient Persians transformed vast stretches of arid land into fertile oases through underground aquifers that drew melted snow water into the desert. And thus, a bright, sensuous, fruit and herb-filled cuisine was born. This week on Aperture, we will follow Javad Gharayi as he explores the amazing deserts of South Khorasan province and visits a charming little village where saffron, the world's most highly prized spice, is grown. Don't miss the first part.
This time, I leave the cold winter weather in the capital city for the beautiful desert flower farms. My destination is the outskirts of South Khorasan province, an area famous for its saffron, Iran's prized red gold. Iran is one of the most mountainous countries in the world, covered by rugged mountain ranges and deserts. 61% of the country has a dry climate. Deserts cover a combined area of around 34 million hectares, scattered among 18 of its provinces. That means around 30% of the country is made up of vast deserts featuring many mountains, salt pans, and sand dunes. Deserts across the world share almost the same features. Little precipitation, intense evaporation of water due to the scorching sun, smothering heat, dry air, great temperature fluctuations, poor vegetation, and a dearth of adequate organic compounds in the soil. However, despite the hostile climate of the deserts of Iran, life is in progress on their margins. I'm Javad Gharai. I'm an Iran trotter, and I'm taking you on a journey to the most pristine areas of my beloved country and showing you their many beauties. Before visiting the Saffron Grove, I decide to take a look around at the desert surroundings on the outskirts of South Khorasan province. To that end, I begin my journey with Halwan Desert, located within 90 kilometers of Tabas, a city in and the capital of Tabas County, in the northwest of South Khorasan. Because of its distance from the urban areas, the natural beauties of deserts are not known to humans as much as they should. If you want to venture out into the desert in order to admire its matchless beauties, you'd have to choose the right season and the right time of day. From a distance, deserts and the wilderness don't seem all that beautiful. Once you've set foot in them, you feel as if you've stepped into a veritable heaven. But a different kind of heaven. You don't see forests with tall trees, grass, or running water. All you can see is streams with very salty water, single salt cedars and saxholes, scattered shrubs and bushes in the landscape, camels and other species unique to this hot and dry climate. It's very beautiful and peaceful here, but that's not always the case. Within minutes, this whole area can turn into an ominously stormy ocean. Ferocious storms of sand and dust that have buried many a caravan and traveler over the course of centuries. In the not-too-distant past, some of Iran's deserts were inhabited by people living in this climate. But thanks to global warming and decreased precipitation that led to drinking water wells drying and parts of the vegetation dying, the people living in such areas were forced to leave their little villages for a better place. Today, those villages lay in ruins on their original locations. Ruins that now serve as shelters for the camel herders against the blazing sun. But these homes of yesterday are still as beautiful as ever. Deserts around the world are expanding by the year. Desert expansion or desertification is a result of global warming, the growth in the human population, unplanned agriculture and excessive firewood collection, depletion of subterranean water resources, industrial contaminants and excessive use of fossil fuels, overgrazing by livestock, and the change in the use of agricultural land. This conversion of habitable and fertile land to uninhabitable desert can happen naturally due to a drought, or can be caused by human activities. Activities that have disturbed the balance of nature on planet Earth. Iran accounts for more than 2% of the world's drought. It's also home to more than 8% of the deserts and arid lands that contain no vegetation, and that is considered a big number. Thank you. but in the fringes of this same hot and dry desert, meaning the one in South Khorasan, there are mountains that supply the rivers and qanats in this area with drinking water. Streams that could be regarded as the natural wonders of this otherwise parched region. Taht-e-Arus, or the Bride's Throne, near the village of Izmiran on the Tabas-Mashhad Road, is a befitting name for this stream. The flowing water reminds me of the celebrations held by people in the old times upon the discovery of clean, fresh water in a hot and dry region. Only those born and bred in a dry climate with limited resources of fresh water appreciate its true value. People who have endured thirst, have felt the baking heat from the sun on their skin, and may have seen rain coming down from the skies over their heads only once a year. The people of Izmiran fit that profile perfectly. God has bestowed upon them fresh water in a stream gushing out of the dry desert mountains around Tebas. And the people here have utmost appreciation for this most precious of God's blessings in the heart of the natural world. In the distant past, the people of Izmiran lived in dwellings carved into mountain wall. With the tools they had, they would dig deep vertical and horizontal holes into the side of the mountains. In them, they'd carve out rooms where they'd live. In the past, these hand-carved chambers were referred to as looms. Desert people are very smart. Using the water from the stream and the fertile soil here, they've been farming rice for generations. Today, the rice produced in Izmiran is among the best in the country. Who would believe there are paddy fields in the middle of a desert and among these mountains? Everybody thinks rice is only grown in the north of Iran. But where does the stream go on this dry land? After irrigating the paddy fields of Izmiran, does it sink into the arid terrain in the areas surrounding the rice farms? That can't be the case, because to the desert dwellers, fresh water is worth more than diamonds. The locals in this area have spoken to me of a formidable yet beautiful canyon and helped me see the rest of the course that the water from Taht-e-Arus spring takes. The name of that canyon is Kala Jinni, the Canal of Jinns, shaped by water movement and erosion over centuries. I'm going to step into a canyon where the water from Taht-e-Arus spring is flowing, but the volume of the water is not large enough to make it to the end of this very long course without going to waste. I'm curious to know how that water continues on its path in the dry land and where it eventually gets to. It's simply beautiful. As I said, the name of the awe-inspiring canyon is Kala Jinni. On its bottom, water from the Taht-e-Arus spring of Tabas is moving as we speak. Most of the way, the water flows between the two walls of this canyon, just like it does in a qanat, and springs out of the underground near Tabas. It's one of the most beautiful sights to see around the city of Tabas in South Khorasan province, the Canal of Jinns. That's a scary name. Kala Jinni was shaped so beautifully by water movements, such as seasonal rain-induced floodwaters over thousands or millions of years. It kind of looks like the Grand Canyon in the U.S., though it doesn't share the same depth. It really is stunning. After a long walk in the mountains, I arrive at the upper end of the canyon. From up here, it's a spectacular deep gorge. I explore the canyon as much as I can, and as long as there is nothing to threaten my life. But as I walk the length of it, Water from Tahta Aruz Spring is nowhere to be found most of the way. The locals have already given me valuable information about that, but to see everything firsthand, I have to walk down to the bottom of the valley, and I do so with gusto and caution. One of the things that renders Kala Jenny even more remarkable is its pristineness. Not many nature travelers come here, and fortunately those who do don't leave behind any kind of waste or garbage. And that has turned this canyon into one of the most must-see natural sites in the Tabas area. There are kanats here. In some places, water has pushed its way out, but there are still other kanats inside walls that continue all the way to the villages of Tabas. And the water originates from the Tahta Aruz Spring in Esmiran province. It's the same water that's come all the way here and has welled out. In the absence of plumbing in the past, they would channel fresh water from one village to another or from the mountains to their villages and farms by means of a kanat system, and they did it to prevent the water from going to waste. This one here is one of those kanats. Out on the bottom of the canyon, the water would sink into the ground. So they channeled the water downhill through a series of gently sloping tunnels along several kilometers to the places where it was needed for irrigation and domestic use. Although new kanats are seldom built today, many old ones are still used in Iran and have until recently served as one of the main reasons behind the continuation of life in areas with hot and dry climates. New technology has in recent years led to a rapid depletion of the underground water reservoirs, but we can still think of reviving the Qanat water supply system, take advantage of this millennia-old experience for agricultural purposes in Iran, and do something to make it happen. I knew very well that the rainfall in the eastern regions of the country is less than half the rain that falls in the western regions. Therefore, water is much more valuable in this part of the country. The people living in these parts have always been thinking of innovative ways of harnessing water and managing its resources. Digging kanats and channeling underground water onto the surface was very common in Iran. They didn't cost much, and they were very efficient. Kanats offered several advantages. Firstly, they prevent the sun from shining directly at the water and making it evaporate. Secondly, moving inside the mountains, not much of the water is absorbed by the bed and walls of the channel. And thirdly, the water is immune to any and all kinds of contamination and flows to its destination clean and cool. What's certain is that humans wouldn't have been able to survive in the desert areas if they hadn't built the kanats. Almost all researchers believe that the world's first kanats were built in areas under Iran's cultural influence. No one knows for sure why the ancient dwellers of this region named this gorge the Kala Jinni, but apparently some of them believe this canyon was haunted by jinns or ghosts. There were others who believed the idea of digging holes and caves into the mountainside for safety was something that even ghosts wouldn't have been able to come up with. Or maybe the reason why this canyon was named the Canal of Jinns was the roaring seasonal floodwaters that swept along this canyon and still do today. Whatever the name, it must have been chosen for a reason. It defies belief that there is so much water in the Kala Jenny Canyon. To the people of southern Khorasan province, each drop of this water is worth as much as a kilo of saffron, and this canyon has a lot of it. It looks like someone has chiseled away at the rocks. The only sound you can hear in the mountains is that of the water rippling along the kanats. Eventually, I get to a point in the canyon where the ancient dwellers of this land redirected the water from the surface to a canal inside the mountain. This is where the water is redirected underground. It was the brainchild of folks who lived here in the distant past. And that beautiful gannet dug inside the wall of the canyon carries this water to the villages lying on the outskirts of Tabas. The locals have told me different things about the cavities and man-made holes inside the Kalajini. Apparently, no one has accurate information on the age of those cave-like shelters. But tales of how they came to be have been passed down from one generation to another. I spend hours scouring the canyon for those man-made tunnels, and I finally find them. It is hard to believe how these tunnels were hand-carved at this height. Niches that acted as footholds to help them climb some 5 or 6 meters to get to the chambers above, where they are likely to have lived. And that was where they felt safe. It's still not clear why these tunnels, these wells, and these chambers were dug into the walls of this canyon and at this height by the people in the past. But many believe they actually lived here. This was the perfect place for people to take shelter in and survive the stifling heat of the Tabas region. And there are many others who believe this was a place where the village dwellers around here, who wanted to steer clear of the brigands and looters, would transfer all their valuable belongings. They themselves would hide here too, along with their belongings, and wait for the looters to leave the area. Of course, there are also others who are of the opinion that these tunnels were just the right place for the people of that time to come to and worship their gods. That in fact they considered this place as their place of worship. They call it the Canal of Jinns for a reason. It can get really scary in some parts. And it's obvious that torrential floodwaters have shaped this valley like this over the years. In fact, what those floodwaters did was wash away the dirt and stones on their path. Of course, it might have taken millions of years for this canyon to take on the shape it has today. It's frightening to be here and walking on the bottom flanked by tall walls. It looks endless to me. I've been walking these smaller gorges near Kalajini for hours, but it looks like there is no end in sight. I haven't been able to get to the other end of any of them. The deeper you go inside, you realize you have more to go. This is a completely virgin valley with no traces whatsoever of human activity in it. Usually, garbage is the first sign of human presence in the natural world. It's clear to me that only people who feel responsible to nature have been to this area before. That is because there is no trash on the ground and no writings on the walls. That has made my trip into the heart of the canyon ever more worthwhile and helped me appreciate its magnificence more intensely. My visit to the Kalajini Canyon has come to an end. I got to see beautiful sights in the canyon from different angles. The canyon has a scary name, but that didn't change my mind about traveling right into it and exploring it. I continue my trek in the desert, this time to see the desert flower, commonly known as the saffron crocus. That means an approximately 200-kilometer walking distance from the Kalajini Canyon. On my way there, the imposing ruins of an ancient building grab my attention. They are the remains of a desolate village by the name of Dihuk. Iranian deserts always have wonderful surprises for travelers, and this beautiful ancient village is one of them. What really tugs at my heartstrings, though, is that the villagers have abandoned these buildings with their unique architecture for brick-and-mortar homes. It saddens me to see traditional Iranian architecture consigned to oblivion by my fellow Iranians in cities and villages. Today, Iranian architecture that encompasses life and vitality, art and aesthetic beauties, and love and positive energy is being replaced by ghastly steel and mortar structures. Architecture that's alien to the Persian culture. Architecture that bears no signs of the ancient Persian culture and doesn't include the freshness, the gardens, the water pools, and other natural features characteristic of traditional Persian architecture. Such homes do not belong in our country, and I wish they'd never been built. In my opinion, this ancient village is one of the most beautiful villages I've ever seen in this area. The people here, I mean the people who used to live here, call this village Ancient Dihuk. Now, they live in a small township by the same name, built around 20 to 25 years ago. It was built after the earthquake in the year 1978. So now they call this place Old Dihuk, which, as I say, is one of the most beautiful villages on the margins of the Lut Desert.
Spiritual message of Islam.
His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. If we all open our eyes to see, he is all that we need right now. And we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. La hawla wa la quwwata illa billahi al-aliyyil azim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen wa sallallahu ala sayyidina wa nabiyyina wa Abil Qasim al-Mustafa Muhammad. Wa ala alihi tayyibin al-tahirin la siyama baqiyatillahi fil aradhin. Ajalallahu ta'ala farajahu al-sharif wa ja'alana min a'wanihi wa ansarihi wa shi'atih. We were discussing some of the main features of the community of Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam, and I talked last night about truthfulness, and I believe that this is a very important quality of a mu'min and also a Muslim community. Inshallah, I hope by the discussion that we have tonight, it will become crystal clear that truthfulness is very fundamental. It's not like some, for example, other qualities that are necessary, but even without them, you can still say I am a mu'min, but not a good mu'min. No, without truthfulness, it's very difficult to be counted as mu'min. Now, I want to start a Quranic discussion here about haq, and inshallah I mentioned some of the major points. It's such a broad concept and such a far-reaching concept in the Quran. Everything starts and ends with haq in the Quran. Allah said to Dawood alayhi salam, fahkum bayna an-nas bil haq. Rule or judge among the people according to haq. You are my khalifa and this is what I want from you. It means that the main task of khalifatullah is to rule and judge according to haq. وَلَا تَتَّبِعِ الْهَوَى. Don't follow your whims, your, you know, lower desires, your lusts. Why? فَيُضِلَّكَ عَنْ سَبِيلِ. Because then they don't let you to understand haq. They misguide you. If you want to satisfy your lower desires, if you want to satisfy your own whims and shahwa and hawa, then you cannot understand the truth. Or even if you understand, you cannot act according to the truth. Those people who stood against Imam Hussein alayhi salam, what was the problem? Either they didn't understand the truth, or if they understood, they found that this is not serving their selfish interests. If they serve Yazid or Ubaydullah, it's better for them
They can have money, they can have, you know, position, they can have, you know, big houses. This ittiba'ul hawa, following your lust and whims, doesn't let you either to understand the truth, or if you understand, you cannot act according to truth. It depends on the intensity. Sometimes it's so intense that you cannot even understand the truth. It blinds you. حُبُّ الشَّيْءِ يُعْمِي وَيُصِمْ. When you really love something or someone, you become blind. You cannot understand anything wrong. You know, sometimes you see teenagers, they fall in love. You say, oh, this person is the only person who has been created for me. I am going to be happy with this person and not happy with anyone else. You know, you say, this person doesn't match you. You know, there is this problem, that problem. No, this is the best person. You say about experience of other people. He says, yes, I know people have had made mistakes, but I'm not making mistakes. You know, I am 100% sure. Then they marry. After a few weeks, problems start. After a few months, separation. Why? Because he was blinded or she was blinded. When you really love someone, and this love, it doesn't originate from aql, it originates from hawa, then you become blinded.
Oh, what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow. His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. Down this road that holds all the answers. Open your heart to something greater. His holy book speaks pure and true, and always tells us what we must do. His last prophet was sent as a guide, an example by which we abide. There is salvation for those who seek to find the one and only source of peace and understanding of why we are here. Who created us, who we must fear. So what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
So Allah said to Dawood, لا تتبع الهوى فيضلك عن سبيل الله. It will misguide you. So you see, this commitment to the truth not only is our aqidah, it is also our akhlaq. Our spirituality is also this. Either you are at the service of truth or you are at the service of your ego. This is the summary of all spiritual life of people. People either they serve the truth or they serve their own ego, which is battered. And shaitan is very clever. Shaitan is our enemy, but always ask us to serve your ego. And because we love our ego, we listen to shaitan. Shaitan doesn't, you know, clearly come says, you know, serve me. If shaitan goes to any person and says, serves me, say, why I should serve you? I don't serve even Allah, why I should serve you? But shaitan says, no, you don't need to serve me, serve yourself. Look after yourself. Enjoy your life. You are young. Do what you want. This is shaitan. Many people are following shaitan, but they think they are serving themselves. This is what we have to be careful. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in the Quran, in Surah Mu'minun, verse 71, وَلَوْ اتَّبَعَ الْحَقُّ أَهْوَاءَهُمْ لَفَسَدَتِ السَّمَاوَاتُ وَالْأَرْضُ وَمَنْ فِيهِنْ. If haq was supposed to follow the desire of people, the wishes of people, the whims and lusts of people, the whole universe would go into chaos, would be corrupted. Because this universe is based on haq. Allah has, in Surah Anfal says, He has created this universe according to Haq. Haq must not follow your desire. Your desire must follow Haq. لَوِتْ تَبَعَ الْحَقُّ أَهْوَاءَهُمْ لَفَسَدَتِ السَّمَاوَاتُ وَالْأَرْضُ وَمَنْ فِيهِنَّ. So you see how fundamental it is if we are not following truth. So we are bringing corruption to whole universe. We are resisting the law of this world if we are not following Haq.
That was the Characters of Shia Community by Hujjatul Islam, Dr. Shomali, in the program The Spiritual Message of Islam.
I'm looking back throughout the years to breathe is hard and my eyes are choked with tears. Your face and hair are full of light. Now it will soon be time to go. I feel you feeling calm now. Did the angel let you know?
O Allah, please send your salutations to Muhammad and all Muhammad. O Allah, please forgive us. Please forgive all our sins and mistakes and shortcomings. Please enable us to serve you with full honesty and truthfulness and sincerity. Please include us among the best followers of Muhammad and all Muhammad. Please protect and safeguard our community and our families and our youths from everything that you don't like. O Allah, please hasten the reappearance of Imam Zaman Ajjalallahu Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif. Please make our Imam Zaman happy with what we do and what we say. Please answer his du'as for his faraj. Please give shifa to all people who are ill. Please give shifa to people who are ill in their body and in their soul. O Allah, please send your rahmah, your forgiveness to all who have passed away, especially brothers and sisters who were attending these majalis in this community and other communities. Our parents, our foreparents, our teachers, our ulama, our maraji, those who have passed away, please let them be with Muhammad and Ali Muhammad right now. And please give long life and blessed life to the parents and to the teachers and maraji who are alive. O Allah, please make the last moment of our life the best moment of our life. Wa akhiru da'wana and alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen.
My Ummah, he will say, Rasulullah on that day, even though we've strayed from him and his way. My brothers, my sisters in Islam, let's struggle, work and pray. If we are to bring back the glory of his way. Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
IRIB English Radio.